It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look at divides in the Democratic Party and how they're playing out in the presidential race.
First, in the thick of primary season, candidates are making their Wisconsin appearances. The state primary is next week, Tuesday. Based on this week's Marquette University Law School poll, Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders look to be the likely winners.
According to the Marquette poll, Sanders has a four-point lead over Clinton, and Cruz is leading the GOP with 40% of likely Republican voters, while national Republican frontrunner Donald Trump has about 30%, Ohio Governor John Kasich, 21%.
Joining us now is WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White, who covered yesterday's Cruz rally. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we also have WPR reporter Parth Shah, who covered yesterday's Bernie Sanders rally. And Parth, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you.
And Laurel, we're going to start with you. So yesterday, Ted Cruz appeared with Carly Fiorina, along with his wife and mother for yesterday's campaign event in Madison. What was the focus of that event?
So Cruz kicked off the event by saying it was a celebration of strong women. And he said that Democrats tend to pigeonhole women by telling them what issues they can care about. And his message of the day was that every issue is a women's issue.
And in attendance, did you see mostly women?
You know, it seemed like a pretty even split, actually, about 50-50.
What kind of questions were there for Ted Cruz and I guess for his mother and wife and Carly Fiorina?
Sure. You know, actually, Ted stayed pretty quiet for the duration of the event. He was sitting back and listening to his mother and his wife and Carly Fiorina speak. And there was a lot of discussion of, you know, raising children, family values, things like that. Some stories about Ted from his childhood.
And what was some of the key messaging that, I mean, Ted Cruz sounds like didn't do a lot of the fielding questions, but what do you think were the takeaways that were going forth there?
Well, I think that really the point of the event was to establish Ted Cruz as a candidate who supports powerful, strong women. I don't think it's any secret that the Republican frontrunner Donald Trump has had some issues with women. I think Cruz was trying to differentiate himself from Trump in that regard.
And did he talk explicitly about that when he was trying to maybe contrast himself with Donald Trump and when it came to women?
You know, he didn't. I think it was sort of a mentioning Trump without mentioning him kind of situation. He was the elephant in the room, in a way.
Well, judging by what I read about the response there, it sounds as though some of the women that were quoted in newspapers were saying that they came away with a different perception of Ted Cruz. You've been covering him. Did you notice anything different about this event that gave a different perspective on who Ted Cruz is as a candidate?
You know, the moderator joked after things were kind of wrapping up that it was a unique event in that a presidential candidate was silent for most of it. And so I think that that was a takeaway that they were trying to instill in audience members, that Cruz was capable of sitting back, giving the stage to others, to women in this case, and taking things in and bringing new perspectives. So I think that it was meant to be a softening event for Cruz.
And as we said, his wife, Heidi Cruz, also there in attendance, and there's been a very public spat, I guess, between the wives of Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, or maybe between the candidates about their wives. Did that come up at all? And did Heidi Cruz address anything about her relationship with Ted Cruz?
You know, the very public spat between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz over Heidi didn't really come up. I think the moderator may have made one kind of quick aside mentioning it. But that really wasn't the focus. I think what they were really trying to do was kind of have a bright, rosy, sunny message. Heidi Cruz spoke about her first date with Ted, and Ted mentioned it again in his closing remarks, how they spent 4 or 5 hours together on their first date and how they were looking to forge a partnership of equals.
Well, Laura, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
And we turn now to Parth Shah, WPR reporter. And you, Parth, were covering Bernie Sanders yesterday. And thanks again for joining us. Now, what did you see yesterday in the crowd leading into this rally?
Yeah, well, so The event was held at the Orpheum Theater in downtown Madison, only a couple blocks down from the UW campus. The streets were lined up. I mean, it was a little rainy yesterday, not pouring, but damp outside. And there were students, members of the community, just lined up for a couple blocks spiraling around the Orpheum Theater. A lot of students were there. At the same time, you see a lot of... I saw a pretty big range of ages. Saw some older folks. And at one point, I remember sitting in the crowd, a woman stood up with her baby in her hand and held him up like Simba and yelled, "Feel the burn," and everyone kind of chimed in. So it was a really active crowd.
And what were some of the main points that Bernie Sanders made yesterday?
So Bernie Sanders touched on a lot of different topics. He started off by taking a jab at Governor Scott Walker, and he said that the state's voter ID law would suppress the vote. He also visited that again at the close of his speech by saying, you know, let's show Governor Walker that he's wrong and that we can come out and actually win this election for him, win this primary. Some other things he touched on were his views on wealth inequality. There's this concept he has of the rigged economy, that the economy is set up to benefit the rich at the expense of the poor and the middle class. And from that, he stemmed out and talked about the need to increase the minimum wage and need to improve family leave policies.
And yesterday, you know, we had this poll come out about Sanders being up over Clinton, I think something like 4 points, pretty tight there. But did he mention that or his strength, the way he saw, perceived his strength in Wisconsin?
Yeah, he definitely talked a lot about his recent wins in Washington, Alaska, and Hawaii, and said that he was in a good momentum and that he's confident that he can win Wisconsin as well. And he did spend a lot of time distinguishing himself from former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And one of those ways, I mean, the crowd was very interactive with him. At the end of most of his statements, they were met with some sort of response by the crowd. But the most enthusiasm I saw, the crowd started chanting, "Bernie, Bernie, Bernie," after he said, "Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, let's see your transcripts of your speeches that you give to Wall Street." And that really got the crowd riled up. I spoke to a student, he's a sophomore here at UW, and he said what really makes him passionate about Bernie Sanders is this stance he has about not accepting large campaign donations, and that's what makes Sanders stand apart from his rival, and that's really what got him enthusiastic about it.
So Sanders, you said, mentioned the transcripts from Hillary Clinton's speeches to Wall Street. Did he say anything else expressly kind of going after her yesterday?
So I think he said that something going after not just Hillary Clinton, but politicians in general, saying that if politicians are receiving millions of dollars and they're all saying that this isn't going to influence my policy, he said, well, he poked at that and said that's complete garbage, that how can you accept money and not be influenced by it? And that wasn't just directed at her, but at all politicians as well. He also talked about Donald Trump yesterday, saying that flat out that he does not believe Donald Trump will be the next president. And he called out Donald Trump's language about Muslims, about Latinos, and saying that it was divisive and it's not what America needs.
Now, he was speaking, I presume, to a pretty young crowd. He was near the UW-Madison campus. Different ages there, but I mean, there were probably a lot of college students. Did he address that demographic, people who are maybe worried about college affordability?
Yeah, he didn't. Actually, the woman who introduced Bernie Sanders spoke about it briefly as well, saying that we need a candidate that can offer free public school tuition for public colleges. But it didn't seem to be a major point of his speech yesterday.
So the main point, would you say he's still sticking closely to what has been his main talking point this entire season, income inequality?
Yeah, that's been his main point. That definitely holds true to his event yesterday.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Laurel and Parth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with WPR reporters Laurel White and Parth Shah, talking about campaign events for both Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz in Wisconsin as we head toward primary week next Tuesday, primary day next Tuesday.
And we've been getting firsthand accounts from our reporters yesterday, and we'll keep doing it up to the event, on some of those Wisconsin campaign events and rallies of the five major party contenders. Coming up, we'll take a look at the Clinton-Sanders race, a closer look, and what it tells us about divides in the Democratic Party and how their debate is playing out here in Wisconsin. You may have noticed the presidential campaign season is well underway, especially here in Wisconsin now. You can make wisconsinvote.org your source for election news and info. You can find out everything you need to know about who's running for office, read candidate profiles, listen to archived interviews and news stories, and even learn how to truth check campaign ads. Once you've made your decision, wisconsinvote.org can help you find your polling place, register, and view a sample ballot so you're ready to cast your vote. Find it all and a lot more at wisconsinvote.org, your source for the 2016 elections. And, of course, here on Central Time, we're tracking what's going on. Both parties now are contending with serious choices in substance and style among their candidates. On the Republican side, you've got Donald Trump's anti-establishment campaign. On the Democratic side, the growing debate between supporters of Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton.
On Tuesday, we looked at the split between Donald Trump and establishment Republicans and the challenge his campaign is presenting to Wisconsin's cheesehead revolution, led by Scott Walker and Paul Ryan.
Now we turn to the Democratic side and how the Clinton-Sanders split is playing out here in Wisconsin. Mike Wagner joins us now. He's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back to the show.
It's my pleasure.
Well, how big are the fault lines in the Democratic Party between the Clinton and Sanders supporters as compared to, you know, the Republican Party, where we're seeing some pretty big fault lines?
There are some big fault lines, especially based on age and race. And so younger voters are overwhelmingly in favor of Bernie Sanders. People over the age of 50 are strongly for Hillary Clinton. There are some gender divides. Men are fairly equal, but young men very strong for Bernie Sanders. Older men over the age of 50 very strong for Hillary Clinton. Sanders does well with people who make between $30,000 and $75,000. Clinton does well with those who make less or more than those kind of ways of thinking about income. So the people who are right in Sanders' wheelhouse for his economic message are the ones who like him the most.
And you mentioned the economic message. How much of this is style? How much of this is substance, substantial differences on policy?
It's a little bit from column A, a little bit from column B. So on the style side, younger voters especially like the fact that Bernie is calling for more of a revolution to the system, really changing the way that business is done in Washington, which echoes, you know, then candidate Barack Obama's message back in 2008. And even though maybe the way business is done hasn't changed or maybe even gotten worse since the Obama presidency, that message still resonates, especially with younger voters. But people do like the substance he's offering on economic issues. Young people especially like the free college plan that Sanders is putting forth, things like that. Whereas the Clinton supporters really point to her track record of not just getting things done, but also stopping the other side from doing things they would like to do, which was something she was really good at in the Senate and something that a lot of her supporters like as well.
Well, you're hitting on a couple big themes there. I want to get into centrism versus sort of left populism
right.
in the Democratic Party. This is not a new story here.
It is not a new story, but it's one that's growing larger with each election. More and more Democrats are identifying as liberal than used to. And so the party is becoming a little bit more extreme, or at least there are more people who are willing to say they're liberal than there used to be. And that's causing some problems for Secretary Clinton in the primary and also helping Bernie Sanders in that same race because more of the liberals are on Sanders' side.
A story we've seen maybe more on the Republican side is this idea that establishment, a lot of experience in government, is a negative in many cases. How is that playing out on the Democratic side?
Well, it's more of a rhetoric battle because Sanders has actually been in government longer than Clinton has, but her perception is that she's been in longer because of her time as Arkansas First Lady, her time as White House First Lady, her time as Senator from New York, her time as Secretary of State. So she's done more things. Sanders has really been, you know, the House of Representatives, the U.S. Senate, more of a creature of Washington, but still has a reputation for being an outsider in Washington and you know, and identified as an independent socialist Democrat or a Democratic socialist, really only became a Democrat per se to run for president and has always been on the outside looking in, even though he's also been in Washington for several decades.
And Clinton, a much more familiar figure on the national stage.
Absolutely.
Even though Sanders has been in politics, as you say, a long time, she's been on front pages for longer than he
right.
has.
Right. Everybody knows who Hillary Clinton is, and until he started running for president, only people who really lived and died with politics knew who Sanders was, or the occasional person who might say, oh, is that the guy from Vermont who's the socialist, and, you know, not really understanding his views or what they were like, or how he would, you know, still vote with the Democrats, you know, almost all the time, but also push them to be more left-leaning with their policy proposals.
Talking to UW-Madison's Mike Wagner about politics, specifically Democratic politics, the splits between the Sanders and Clinton camps. Well, how does this all play out, particularly here in Wisconsin? What's the appeal of both candidates on a Wisconsin stage?
The real fight is between voter turnout in Madison and Milwaukee. Madison is a stronger support center for Sanders because of the university, but also because he's doing very well with college and above educated folks in the Madison area. And so there are a lot of those folks in the Madison area, and more of them seem to like Senator Sanders than Secretary Clinton. And so the fact that this race is still close bodes well for him, and he's doing a little bit better statewide, whereas Secretary Clinton does very well in Milwaukee, especially with Black and Hispanic voters, where she has very strong advantages over Sanders, and might be helped by the hot mayor's race in Milwaukee, which is also on the ballot. And so she's really hoping for turnout there related to the Tom Barrett race, but also related to her own. And then, of course, broadly in Wisconsin, the Kloppenburg-Bradley Supreme Court race on the Democratic side are really hoping for strong turnout from this close race, whereas Republicans, of course, would prefer to see Bradley retain her seat.
Now, Hillary Clinton, speaking in Milwaukee, focused a lot on the gun control issue and gun violence. And
right.
This is one issue where it seems like she's been trying to present herself as being to the left of Bernie Sanders, saying he is more aligned with Republicans and gun rights supporters. How do you think that's going to be an effective message for her?
Well, it's an area where she can show that she has a voting record that's a little bit to the left of Sanders's. And so on economic issues, Sanders is clearly to the left and more progressive than Clinton. But on gun issues, she has been more liberal, more supportive of issues in the Black community related to people's attitudes about firearms. And so you can kind of see the places where their support lie are also correlated with their kind of slightly competing positions on guns.
On those economic issues, do you see Sanders pulling Clinton to the left?
Oh, for sure. I think it, you know, she might not. Well, never. We can't read what's in her mind, of course. But, you know, she may not have been as critical of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which she used to really support, if Sanders had not been running and doing so well. She probably wouldn't have been talking about some of the big Wall Street issues and issues of broad economic inequality had Sanders not been doing as well as he is doing. I think he certainly pulled her to the left. And even if Sanders isn't able to win, Clinton will have a hard time walking those positions back because she's taken them so strongly during the campaign.
There's a lot of focus on those trade issues. You mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership in places like Ohio and Michigan.
Right.
Democratic and Republican side, elements of both parties feeling like they're not represented in the mainstream of those parties. Is this a voting issue here in Wisconsin, do you think?
I don't know that that's a voting issue in Wisconsin, unless you think about it in this sense. A lot of people and a lot of Sanders supporters and a lot of Trump supporters feel left behind by the economic recovery. A lot of these are white working class voters. And even though they don't, the people who like Trump and the people who like Sanders don't agree with each other, they both feel left behind by the economic recovery. And both Sanders and Trump have messages for those folks. Trump's message is, you can't trust the elites, you can't trust the media, you can't trust the system, you can only trust me. Sanders' message is, we need to change how we do things because the way we're doing things is rigged to harm you in particular.
Some Sanders supporters have been saying lately, at least prominently online, Bernie or bust. They would not vote for Hillary Clinton if she's the nominee in the general election. Do you think that's likely to play out to be a significant difference?
I don't think that that's likely to be a significant difference because of Ralph Nader in 2000. And so a lot of the people saying those things, Susan Sarandon, the actress, comes to mind in recent days, who's gotten a lot of attention for saying that, were people who are also Nader supporters. And a lot of Democrats who are more progressive than maybe the general election candidate tends to be saw George W. Bush and not Al Gore get elected in 2000. And, you know, say what you will about Al Gore, he was not likely to have invaded Iraq in 2003. And so who wins these races matters. And the support a spoiler or sit a race out because you don't like how centrist your party's candidate is usually a recipe for disaster for your broader interests with respect to what you think about and what your party wants to do.
Now, you mentioned Tuesday the big issue for the both candidates is going to be how big the turnout is and where that turnout is. Let's situate Wisconsin now in the wider campaign. How important are we in Wisconsin for Sanders versus Clinton?
Way more important than we thought we were going to be, yeah. I think, at this time. On the Democratic side, Wisconsin is important, but not as important as it is on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, both Sanders and Clinton are going to do well. They're going to probably both get somewhere between 40% and 50% of the vote, and they'll split those votes proportionally, which will allow Clinton to maintain the slight lead she has in votes from the people and her larger lead in terms of the superdelegate votes, at least so far. Now, on the Republican side, it's not quite winner take all. You get a lot of delegates for winning the state, but you also get three for winning each congressional district. And there's not a lot happening on the Republican side for a few weeks. And so if the Stop Trump movement can be successful and have Ted Cruz win in Wisconsin, that's 2 weeks of stories about Donald Trump might not be inevitable anymore, which is what they would really need to get the party to coalesce around an alternative.
Lot to watch on Tuesday. Mike, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Mike Wagner. He's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. We were looking at the presidential race and how it's playing out here in Wisconsin on the Democratic side of things.
Coming up, this final week of March has been dedicated to highlighting Black women in history. Our next guest tells us about a series she helped launch highlighting the trials and triumphs faced by women of color in America. And starting Monday, you'll hear new voices and new perspectives during our evening lineup on the Ideas Network with shows like The Political Junkie, which is going to air Fridays at 7 o'clock. Also, check out the Dinner Party Download Fridays at 10 o'clock. Some fun talking points to get you through any dinner parties you're having that weekend. And some of your old favorites are going to be moving to new times, like The Moth on Thursdays at 7, and Q is going to be airing at 9 o'clock. You can see the entire schedule and learn about our new programs online at WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. 2016 has been the second year in a row to have an official Black Women's History Week. The month of March is Women's History Month, and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York entered the last week of the month as a period dedicated to the history of Black women in particular.
There's a long history of Black women's participation in social justice movements, but our next guest says issues facing Black women have often been overlooked and marginalized.
She decided to kick off a series of events highlighting different issues and challenges facing women and girls of color. The series is called Her Dream Deferred, and it's taking place during this last week of March.
Kimberly Crenshaw joins us now. She's creator and coordinator of the Her Dream Deferred Project. She's a law professor at Columbia University and UCLA and director of the Center for Intersectionality and Social Policy Studies. And she's also the executive director of the African American Policy Forum. Kimberly, welcome back to Central Time.
I'm so happy to be back. Thanks.
Why did you decide that now was the right moment to launch Her Dream Deferred?
Well, there had been a range of debates over the last couple of years that dealt with the fact that we don't really have much of a sense of what is happening to women and girls of color in education, in employment, in the criminal justice system. We were a group that helped to coordinate something called Why We Can't Wait, and it was a response to President Obama's My Brother's Keeper initiative, which, although was welcomed and important, dealt only with the challenges facing men and boys of color. And we thought that one of the reasons that was the case is that people just don't know what's happening to women and girls of color. And in fact, there are assumptions that girls and women of color are doing okay. The real problem is their sons and their brothers and their fathers. So in both pushing to broaden the scope of intervention on behalf of youth of color in particular, we thought it was also important to have an affirmative opportunity opportunity for people to hear about what actually is happening. So this is the decade of the UN Declaration for Afro Descendants, and we thought, well, it is an excellent opportunity to begin a week in Women's History Month that focuses on Afro descendants who are actually women and girls. So fortunately, Senator Gillibrand was equally convinced that this was an important thing to do. She partnered with us and some of our partners to have this week declared as Black Women's History Week, and that was the beginning.
I mean, here it is 2016. Why do you think it is that there is this missing data when it comes to women and girls of color?
Well, you know, the missing data is just one of many things that falls through the cracks of race and gender as we understand it. So many years ago, I started doing work in this field and paid attention to the fact that the way we think about race and race discrimination usually is predicated on how men experience racism. And the way that we think about gender discrimination tends to be predicated on the way that women who are not also people of color or who are not also queer or are not also working class experience it. So when you have limited frameworks, it is easy for data to fall through the cracks, for experiences to fall through the cracks, visibility of the particular ways they experience these issues falls through the cracks. I think a good example of that, to go back to what I was just saying, is that one of the things that the president mandated when he initiated My Brother's Keeper was a command to agencies to produce information, data on the status of men and boys of color as a way of beginning a conversation about what kind of interventions could be brought up to scale to actually make a difference. And that was really important work. What's frustrating about it is that it did not also mandate that data about women and girls of color should also be collected by these agencies. So we don't have as much information as we should have. And because of that, it is sometimes difficult to really create the public will to develop the attention and the kind of interventions that would be necessary to make a difference in their lives as well.
How would you say that the issues and the missing data for women and girls of color is different from men and boys of color?
Well, there are ways in which it's different and also, frankly, ways in which it's the same. So we did a report last year called Black Girls Matter, pushed out out of school. And one of the main things we were trying to look at is whether the school-to-prison pipeline actually plays out for girls in the way that it plays out for boys. And we did find that, like boys, girls, Black girls in particular, were several times more likely to be suspended, for example, than their white female counterparts. What was different was, first of all, the level, the magnitude of difference between Black girls and white girls and Black boys and white boys was dramatically greater. Black boys are three times more likely to be suspended than white boys, and that in and of itself is a serious social problem. But Black girls are six times more likely to be suspended than their white female counterparts, in some places 10 and 11 times. So there's a sameness in the sense that race is a factor. There's a difference in the sense that for girls, it's far greater. So we wanted to find out, well, what actually is happening. And one of the things that a lot of the young women told us is that Black girls are more likely to be seen as having a particular kind of negative attitude. They're more likely to be suspended because they are aggressively engaging in classroom dialogue in a way that teachers interpret as being hostile or as being defiant. So as girls, as women, there are differences in the way that girls who are Black or girls who are Latina experience both sexism but also racism. And last but certainly not least is the fact that girls are more likely, of course, to experience sexual harassment. Women are more likely to experience sexual abuse. And the particular consequences of sexual abuse for women and girls who are stereotyped through racial stereotypes as more likely to engage in sex, more likely to do a whole range of things that are risk factors, actually contributes to the deterioration of their well-being. So, yeah, it's both the ways that race creates similar kinds of challenges for people of the same racial background, but also the ways that gender actually shapes and changes those risks in very different ways.
We're talking with Kimberly Crenshaw right now. She's a law professor at UCLA, and she's the coordinator and creator of the Her Dream Deferred event, which focuses on issues facing women and girls of color. And in some of the materials talking about your event, you said that the moment that we're in now is a unique moment because of the social emphasis right now being placed, for instance, on the Black Lives Matter, the awareness and the desire to learn more across big spectrums of people in different areas and disciplines. So what makes this moment unique, would you say?
Well, I think one of the things that makes the moment unique is that we're having a conversation about race again. And that is significant given the fact that for the last 6 or 7 years, for the most part, there's sort of been this belief that race was fading away, that we were in a post-racial moment. And as a consequence, things that we traditionally would talk about as racial problems became talked about as something else, class problems sometimes, or problems in terms of motivation, et cetera. And I think what Black Lives Matter and other activists managed to put back on the table is that race continues to be a significant factor in differentiating the kinds of things that happen to different kinds of people. I think in particular, Black Lives Matter raising the question of police violence against Black people in particular actually re-energized a conversation about something that was ongoing but hadn't really been talked about. What also makes this particularly important for those of us who are interested in how women experience race is the way in which even that conversation has to be broadened. So one of our other projects is called Say Her Name, and that is in response to and in coordination with Black Lives Matter as a way of ensuring that when we're talking about Tamir Rice and Eric Garner, we're also talking about Tanisha Anderson and Michelle Cusseau, two Black women who were killed within weeks of well-known Black men who were killed. But we don't really have them in the conversation because we don't imagine police brutality as something that happens to Black people who are women as well as Black people who are men. So all of this is made possible because we're having a conversation about race, but we're also trying to broaden and expand the way that we think about race and racism as we move forward to try to create more effective strategies to address some of these problems.
We're talking right now with Kimberly Crenshaw, creator and coordinator of the Her Dream Deferred Project. It's a week-long series highlighting the challenges facing women of color.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What unique challenges do you feel women of color are facing in the United States today? How well do you think they're being addressed, talked about? Are they being talked about at all? How do you see this playing out in your daily life, in the workplace, and at schools with African-American girls, as you're hearing, with much higher suspension rates than their white peers? And if you're an African-American woman yourself, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about all this? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're picking up our discussion now with Kimberly Crenshaw, the creator and coordinator of the Her Dream Deferred Project. She's a law professor at UCLA and Columbia University. And we're talking about the status of Black women in the United States.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're an African-American woman, maybe living here in Wisconsin, what kind of challenges do you see? Do you feel overlooked in the attention to women? Is it focused mostly on white women? And when we talk about race, do people mostly talk about men of color? What do you, whoever you are, think needs to change to help the status of Black women and girls in Wisconsin, in the United States? How do you see these unique challenges, unique issues playing out in daily lives and maybe in classrooms around the state if you're a teacher? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Kimberly, let's get to another one of the issues that Her Dream Deferred gets at. And this is the perception of Black single mothers in our society. Mm. Now, you say that in terms of, you know, the society at large, you know, white single mothers are beginning to be perceived more favorably, but that does not extend necessarily to Black single mothers. What are you seeing?
Absolutely. Well, in our session, Standing Up for Mom, Resisting the Vilification of Black Single Moms, we trace the problem back to the Moynihan Report, which, as some of your listeners likely know, was a report by Daniel Patrick Moynihan that essentially argued that the problems of the Black community were never going to be solved by any kind of governmental program or other kinds of structural interventions, as long as the family was so much at odds with the traditional nuclear family. And he pointed his finger specifically at something that he called the Black matriarchy, which was this idea that Black women were overly aggressive, were taking up the role of men in their families and in their communities, and recommending that one of the ways to fix this problem was to beef up the masculinity of men and boys, engage in military service. These were ideas that were predicated on, as we say, the failure to contest racial discrimination as well as patriarchy or sexism at the same time. Unfortunately, this idea has more or less stretched across the decades, although it was really controversial when he first issued the report. Now there's more of a sense of revisiting his ideas, a sense that, well, maybe, you know, he was right after all. Look at the fact that some of the worst outcomes and most poverty exists among single moms. And our point is that marriage is not necessarily the thing that lifts people out of poverty. There are plenty of two-parent families that are desperately poor. The problem is the economic position of so many women, particularly women of color, who barely make a living wage. One of our reports that was reported on yesterday by Heidi Hartman and her colleagues from the Institution for Women's Policy Research found that reducing the gender wage gap would reduce the poverty rate by more than 40% in the South. So what we're actually looking at is discrimination against women, against low-wage women, and those are disproportionately women of color. That's the problem. It's not the problem that they're matriarchs, or the problem, frankly, that they may have chosen to have families without male partners.
Let's get a caller in on this now. We've got Nikki joining us from Elkhorn. Nikki, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
Actually, it's just touching base on the fact that as Black girls, we are more likely to be suspended from high school. I graduated from Cudahy High School about 6 years ago, going on now. And one of the issues that I faced was when it came to our dress and the way that we would dress. I would wear shorts to a certain length, and a principal or a vice principal would come up to me and tell me, you know, that I couldn't wear that, but my mother even saw a white girl walking past with shorter shorts on, and nothing was said to her. She was never sent home, never asked to change, but I was. And I was sent home a couple of times for doing that. And again, too, that was something that I found, it wasn't right, it wasn't fair, that we were picked on more because of, you know, being thicker as well, our shorts rise up. Mm-hmm. But being white girls, you know, some things, they look different on different people.
Nikki, I'm so glad you called and shared that. And Kimberly, what goes through your mind when you hear a story like
that? Well, yeah. So we've been doing focus groups across the country, and we've been asking young girls of color precisely that question. And Nikki, you are not alone. Girls in Los Angeles and girls in Philadelphia have been telling us exactly the same thing. They will wear something that is virtually identical to something that one of their white classmates might wear, and they're picked kicked out from the larger group of girls and told they have to go home. They can't wear that. So they've been asking, what is this telling us about our bodies? What is it telling us about what people think about when they see our bodies, such that the same item of clothing on me somehow looks obscene, but the item on someone else looks different. So there is a growing awareness of the fact that this is there's a particular kind of body shaming that girls of color are experiencing that other girls are not. Beyond that, of course, is the consequences of being sent home and sometimes even being suspended. So one of the things that we noted is that when girls are suspended, the likelihood of a future suspension is great. The likelihood of disconnection is great. Sometimes certain things happen to girls when they're suspended and not in school during the day because they're not always safe. So these might look like minor kinds of problems, but they often turn into far more significant problems that lead to girls being disconnected from school altogether.
Well, Nikki, thank you so much for calling. And Kimberly, let's touch on another aspect of this I thought was particularly compelling, the story of Black women veterans and how there's a seems to be systemic inequality in the military and their experience there. What have you found?
Yeah, so we're really really excited about this conversation because we don't see a lot of it. But this actually is happening tomorrow in our series. So one of the things that I was just stunned to find out is that the data suggests that 1 in 3 women will experience some form of sexual assault while they're serving their country. And that in and of itself should just have us up in arms, that you know, people who are serving our country are, in fact, not being protected while they're actually doing so. But beyond that, we know that many of the same things that happen in broader society when Black women are sexually assaulted seem to also be happening in the armed forces, namely the likelihood that they'll not be believed, the higher rate of unfounding, namely saying that we don't think anything happened here, concern and fear. About backlash if they actually report a sexual assault, particularly in context in which it's an intra-racial sexual assault. We were just talking about that today in historically Black colleges and universities where some of our participants were Black college students who said that they were also pressured not to tell the stories about what happened to them, both because of concerns about making the university or the college look bad, or having a negative consequence on another African-American male, recognizing, of course, that there's been a history of unfair prosecution against men. So we wanted to bring all of these conversations into greater visibility, number one, for women and girls, particularly of color, to know that going into the armed forces might be something that they should really think about and have a plan for maintaining their safety, and also to help put pressure on the armed forces to be more accountable when women and girls have had these, when women have had these experiences.
Kimberly, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Kimberly Crenshaw, the creator and coordinator of the Her Dream Deferred Project. She's also a Columbia Law professor and executive director of the African American Policy Forum. You can find more about the series on the Central Time Facebook page.
When you think of state parks in Wisconsin, there's a good chance one particular park comes into your mind, captures your imagination, Devil's Lake State Park.
And if you're a fan of that park, you're not alone. It just got some national attention. USA Today's travel website, 10best.com, just listed Devil's Lake as the 5th best state park in the United States as rated by an expert panel.
I feel kind of bad sometimes for all the other state parks because there are a lot of good ones. But if when I pick one, it almost feels like a cliche, Devil's Lake. I mean, that's the one. It's just, it's so unique.
It kind of has the complete package, I should say. It's got rock climbing, it's got bluffs, it's got hiking, and it's got a lake.
Yeah, you could be really active. You can do dangerous stuff up in the bluffs. You can walk the high road. mellow walk on the lower road. You can just sit on the beach and do nothing. It has all the options, and it's beautiful.
It's a fabulous park. I have slightly mixed associations. My husband took us there for a surprise date when we were dating, which turned out to be climbing a sheer rock face. So it's not my favorite date ever. I did survive, and the view was gorgeous. I'll say the view was incredible.
And it was probably even better because of all the effort it took to get there. Maybe not. Well, hey, you can hear more about that ranking of Devil's Lake and about Wisconsin State Parks in general tomorrow morning after 6 here on the Ideas Network. Call in with your favorites, too.
Coming up next is news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll find out why Wisconsin has been great at picking the next presidential nominee. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.